Bem-vindos to one more episode of the Type Theory for All podcast. As always, this is your host, Pedro Abreu. And in today's episode, we continue our conversation with David Christiansen. He wrote the books Functional Programming and Lean and The Little Typer. This episode, we continue our conversation in the previous episode, and we get a little more in the story of writing The Little Typer together with Tim Friedman. And we also get very technical, talking about bidirectional type checking, quasi-quotation, quotation, and those really cool things. This podcast is made possible thanks to our sponsor, Formoland. Formoland is a formal verification company focused on verifying the implementation of programs with the Cock Proof Assistant. They have been working on the verification of Rust and OCaml code for the blockchain industry, in particular for Tezos and Aleph Zero. So if you're looking to ensure an extra layer of correctness to your blockchain, you should take a look on Formoland's work. Hello, everyone. We are back to the Type Theory for All podcast, to the part two of my conversation with David Christiansen. Welcome to the show again, David.
Thank you.
How are you?
Doing okay. A little tired, but...
Today, it's going to be only you and me. Dan is not here. He could not join us. But I hope you'll not get too tired of me. So... I was thinking that we can start today's conversation talking a little more about The Little Typer, which we didn't have the occasion for the last time.
Sure.
Could you tell us a little, you know, like the story behind how you got in contact? What is, oh my God, I forgot the name of the other author. I'm
very sorry. Dan Friedman.
Dan Friedman.
Yeah. He's the famous one.
Yes, I should remember.
So for those who don't know what The Little Typer is, it's a little book. For those who don't know what little books are, they started with The Little Lisper, later renamed The Little Schemer in a later edition. And the idea is to show some deep idea from programming languages in a fashion where there's as few prerequisites as possible using a somewhat unconventional presentation. So typically they're written as a dialogue between like the left-hand column of the page and the right-hand column of the page. And typically they're using some sort of very minimal version of whatever it is they're teaching. You know, so not only is it Scheme, but it's like this sort of minimal Dan Friedman dialect of Scheme in The Little Schemer, which has got like 13 operators in it. And the idea, you know, like The Little Schemer is all about recursive functions, and the Season Schemer is all about continuations and so on and so forth. And it became this big franchise after the first one was written. And, you know, The Little Typer is about dependent types. And this came about because back in 2014, I was an intern at Galois, and there was a colleague of mine there, Adam Fulzer, who knew Dan. He grew up in Bloomington, and he was taking, you know, Dan's programming languages class when he was younger than most of the students in that class. And, you know, they got along really well. And, you know, he said like, oh yeah, you're working on this Idris system. And I know Dan's gotten interested in dependent types lately. So how about I put you in touch? Because oftentimes when Dan wants to learn something or he thinks an idea is interesting, he'll find someone to write a little book with, because in order to get the kind of explanation you want, he has to really learn it. And so, yeah, then we got in touch with each other. We met up, I think it was at ESOP or something in Prague, and discussed it. And we're trying to figure out like, okay, how are we going to actually physically make this work? And then I ended up doing a postdoc at Indiana University, sort of by happy coincidence. And then, you know, we'd sit down every Friday and crank it out. You know, it just like work from, you know, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., kind of majorly zoomed in on the screen and trying to get every little detail right. Just, we started off trying to implement the smallest usable dependently typed language we could. The goal was that the entire implementation would fit as the last chapter of the book, which is the tradition for these little books. We didn't get that far, unfortunately, so we had to write inference rules, which is something I'm a little sad about. But, you know, we made some course notes on the side to make up for the lack of the implementation in the book. And then we went on from there to figure out, like, okay, how do we assume, like, assuming that somebody has, like, written some recursive functions, they're comfortable with Lambda, how do we get from there to basic familiarity with the core of dependent types, which for me means you can prove decidability of equality for natural numbers using eliminators. Because that's like something where you need to have like a non-trivial motive for the application of the eliminator. And you have to think a little bit about like how you actually construct it. You know, it's not just a sort of plug it in and mechanically translate it from the recursive function kind of situation. And, you know, it's a very useful thing to have. And at the same time, it's not too big. So I think that's like, that's where we wanted to get to. And we tried to chart a course through that. And then we ended up with a slightly less little book that we wanted, like a little more of a medium-sized book. But, you know, if we call it the medium-sized typer, then people would have been very confused in the bookstores. And while we were writing it, we knew that for a book like this, it was really important for potential, like, people from the target audience to actually read it, because at the beginning, you know, Dan didn't know a ton about the topic. Like, you know, he has a very good background in programming languages, but sort of less in dependent types. But he gets that background by us sitting there together. And so we needed to find more people who didn't know it yet, who could read it, and who maybe had less of his deep background knowledge. And so we taught a class at IU. And so what we would do is we'd sit down and we'd write a draft of the chapter for a week. And then we'd hand it, you know, we'd sit down on Friday, write our draft. You know, Dan would like proofread it on like Monday. I think the class was Tuesday, Thursday. I'm not entirely sure. You know, we handed
undergrads or
we cross-listed it. So for undergrads or grad students. Yeah, I mean, so the expectation was that for undergrads, you'd taken the undergrad PL class, which was at IU is a lot of like writing interpreters for interesting languages and sort of working through the consequences of them. And you know, so people there, they'd written an interpreter for a scheme, for lots of sort of scheme like languages. They'd worked with like Minikanren and things like that. So, but they weren't coming in with a lot of, you know, abstract algebra and category theory and logic and that kind of thing necessarily. Like some of the grad students certainly did, but we didn't aim it at those people. Yeah, so we'd sit down on Friday, write our draft. Dan would be proofreading it Monday while I was off doing my normal postdoc stuff, you know, working on my actual project. Then we'd be handing out the draft on Tuesday, and so, you know, students would then be reading it, and then they'd come in on Thursday and be like, this makes no sense. Then we could be like, okay, cool. Then we'd make a better version of the chapter and hand that along with the next chapter, and it was really fun. Very, very intense, but I think it was a good process because there's a lot of things like chapter 9 is the part that I'm least satisfied with, which is where we get into the equality type, just mm-hmm. because it's hard. Like
it is very hard.
It's just a hard topic, right?
Yes.
But originally chapters 8 and 9 were one chapter and it was much shorter, and that really didn't work. So we found out like, okay, we need a lot more examples here because everybody is falling off. And so we may not have had that feedback without being able to teach the class. So I was really grateful that we could do that, both to the university and the students who showed up for it. And then on Thursdays, we'd usually be teaching people how to implement the things that we were learning on Tuesday, because, you know, we Dan and I share the idea that you should be able to, in principle at least, understand your tools well enough that you could implement them.
So this was implemented in Racket?
Yeah, we did the implementation bit in Racket. I taught a later iteration of the course at Portland State University while I was working at Galwa, and there we used Haskell because that's what the students there knew. So I like the language we're implementing it in didn't really matter. The you know, the thing that matters is like the ideas behind how you do it.
Right. Of course.
Like Java would have been fine as well. A little more verbose, but like pattern matching really helps a lot when you're writing a time checker.
Yeah. I have a feeling that developing languages in Racket is much easier, and it gives you more usable features. I've never used Racket though, so that's where that question comes from.
Yeah, so I think I wrote similar amounts of code for the version of Pi, the book in the language. We called it Pi, like the sweet thing you eat, PIE. not Proto-Indo-European, that's a different language, but... Then the implementation of Pi that we in Racket and in Haskell, I haven't counted, but they seem broadly similar in the lines of code. And like the Haskell implementation is like a batch mode thing and a REPL, and the you know, the Racket implementation has like, you know, it, there's the IDE, and it's got like tool tips that give you little, I'm gesturing with my hand, which podcast listeners won't see, but like, you know, you put the mouse over a thing and it shows you what type it is. And like adding that was like 10 lines of code. And, you know, I wrote a little bit more lines of code to make it so like get like an AGDA style goal view. So you could like leave behind a hole in your program. And then it would pop up little things saying like all of the to-do, like we called the whole operator to-do, because we thought that like the to-do list was a nice metaphor for talking about this rather than talking about a program with holes in it, which is like the conventional way of talking about it, but maybe less intuitively appealing to what's going on. Whereas the to-do list is like, okay, this is what's left to do in order to get the proof done.
Yeah.
You know, so it would pop up the to-do list at the bottom with like the types of all the things. You click on them and jump to them. And that was accomplished in a fairly small amount of code. And yeah, like Racket makes it, Racket is really designed so that you can swap out the language front end. Essentially, you can have your own parser, your own concrete syntax. You know, like there's a nice data log implementation in Racket, where it's just the usual data log syntax. There was a cool paper a while back where they did a you know, not all of Java, but like enough of Java for it to feel like Java, and like, you know, the built-in rename refactor thing just works without doing any extra work because of the way that the parsing infrastructure fits together and all of that. So it's really fun. And then you can override sort of what the meanings of definitions are at like top level definitions. You can say, oh, like do it this way or do this other thing instead. You can hook in and say like, oh, when somebody types something at the REPL, do this. There are some things you can't do easily in it. Like you can't make something that works incrementally without, I don't know how to do it. I'm sure you can do it. Like some Racket expert is going to listen to this and be like, come on, David. But like if you're using it the way it's intended to be used, then what you'll end up with is a system where, you know, you type in and then like it goes and like elaborates your whole program and then comes with your feedback, as opposed to like elaborating the top and giving you feedback as it goes. So, you know, you can't do every kind of user interaction you'd want to do for a programming language on top of Racket easily, but you can get from like a really simple interpreter to like a fairly usable IDE in, you know, a day of work. And then you can get from there to like a pretty nice one in another 3 or 4 days of work. And like, there's a bit of a ceiling imposed by the system. Like if you want to be like super hyper-specific to the structure of some language that's very unlike the default Racket, then probably you'll have to work pretty hard. But most of the time, that's not what you're doing, right? Like most times you're implementing a language, like, you know, either it's a big professional thing where you're just going to put in the work to do the fancy IDE and not use the built-in thing, and that's okay. Or it's like a thing that like one or two people are doing kind of on the side, or it's an early prototype or something like that. And for those cases, it's just really, really wonderful.
Now, you've also mentioned that you are not super satisfied with the chapter on equality. Let's talk a little more on what makes equality so hard.
What does make equality hard? I think it was Connor McBride who said like the history of types, that the history of the struggle for equality, right? I mean, one of the big learning moments I had in understanding dependent types, like I used to like really focus on the like this thing has this type form of judgment, but actually no, you want to look at the this thing equals this thing judgment. That's where the real action is, right? And I kind of realized that when I was at this lecture by Bob Harper at OPLSS way back when, and I was like, oh, wow, I see things differently now. Because, you know, assigning a type to a thing, okay, fine, you can do that. But if you didn't have the conversion rule, then that would be an extremely tedious thing to do. Like, you know, you the whole point of dependent types in some sense is that there's a non-trivial theory of equality on terms, which is respected by the type system when those terms occur in the types. And the equality judgment is where all of that happens. And there's a lot of...
You mentioned the conversion rule. What is that?
Yeah. Sorry, the conversion rule. So the conversion rule says that if M has type A and A is equal to B, then M also has type B.
Ah, right. Yeah.
And here when I say E is equal to, I mean sort of equal in the sense that types can be equal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. And so we typically distinguish between at least two kinds of equality. Traditionally, two kinds. There's the judgmental equality and the propositional equality. So, mm-hmm. and people use different terminology here. I think definitional equality is probably what most people are saying these days, actually, for the first one. And the term propositional equality is been challenged a little bit by cubicle type theory and such, but you know, we'll turn back the clock a decade and none of that stuff happened. And we're sort of in the dependent types as they were in the, you know, in the early 2010s. And so there we have, you know, we have a system of judge. We want to talk about, like, we're putting together theory, right? And so that theory is, first off, well, we're going to have syntax. Like, we've got some expressions and, like, things that are not syntactically well-formed, we're not going to talk about. Like, you know, we're not going to go back to the old days where logicians spent a ton of time, like, defining, like, parenthesis matching and like, well-formed formulas and all that. No. Like, it's, we've made progress as a field. We can write a grammar and say, okay, we have our terms. But once we have those, then we want to say things about them, right? So, and the language in which we are saying things is not the language of the terms. It's like a meta language, right? It's the thing that we're talking about the system in, and that's the language of judgments. There's a Pam Martinleff has this great paper on this, which I can never remember the entire. I always get the name wrong, so I hope you can look it up and put it in the show notes. But it's something along the lines of like proof of a proposition, evidence of a judgment, something of a something. But yeah, so the idea is that we have these judgments, which are the meta language statements we're making about our system. And in things that are descended from Martinleff's type theory, we've typically got four forms of judgment. If you want to be super pedantic, then you say a form of judgment is like the kinds of sentences we might say with like holes in them where we could put the terms. And then an actual judgment is one where we've actually put them in. And right, so a form of judgment might be this, like a thing has a type. And an actual judgment might be 5 has type nat.
Right.
And so typically we've got four forms of judgment. We've got this thing is a type. These two types are equal, or they are the same type in some sense. And then we've got that this expression has this type. And then we've got that these two expressions are equal to each other. And sometimes you write that down as like they're equal elements of this type, and sometimes you just say they're equal to each other, depending on which specific theory you're in and which particular ideological tradition you grew up in and or have later converted to, or which technical thing you need to get your paper done. I don't know. I grew up having the type be part of the equality because that lets you do some cool stuff, but. That was a lot of the influence from the UK and the Swedish traditions coming in from my own personal formation. You know, at the end of the day, you should do the thing that gets your paper done and has the properties you need. But then we typically try to write these rules so that you can have an algorithm that will check whether or not a particular form of judgment. You could say whether it holds or whether it's evident, depending on your thing. Like, so like, do we have a derivation for this judgment? Like, what is the derivation that 5 is nat? Well, okay. Well, 5 is syntactic sugar for, I'm going to say 2. 2 is a nat. We've got, it's a syntactic sugar for successor of 0. I'm going to say, okay. So, you know, well, what's our rule for successor? Okay. Our rule for successor is that like the thing inside of it has better be type nat. So like, oh, that's a successor. We'll do that rule. Okay, the thing inside of that would be a nat. Oh, 0 is already a nat. Okay, cool. So 2 is a nat. That judgment holds, or that judgment is evident.
Right.
And the reason we want this to be algorithmically checkable is that is it writing those derivations by hand is really painful.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this isn't a thing that we've always done, right? I mean, like, the initial dependent type theories were typically what we call extensional type theory, where for various reasons, it's not decidable. It's not algorithmically checkable, right? And things can be undecidable in like various ways, right? Like you could have an undecidable system, which is like, you know, Scala 2. You could, if you worked hard enough, put a Turing machine in the type system and you knew that you were doing it. And like no one accidentally wrote a Turing machine in the type system and it's fine, right? Like it's technically undecidable, but like in practice, all the things you care about are decidable.
Mm-hmm.
And And furthermore, you're going to run into like resource limitations before you ever run into undecidability issues anyway, because like what we care about in practice is not that it's decidable. Like we philosophically care that it's decidable depending on our personal beliefs, but like a thing can be decidable and nonetheless the algorithm to decide it is going to take, you know, 30,000 years to run for simple programs, and so we don't care. You know, we're going to hit control C or our computer's going to break down before it finishes, so whatever, right? But like existential type theory is like undecidable in the sense that in order for the thing to say here's a type error, it would need to be able to like prove arbitrary theorems, and like that's not going to work. But you know, but in sort of the main line of what we do in dependent types, we rig up our judgments such that they are decidable so that we may let the computer decide them for us. But then we're left with like, okay, we had to remove some expressive power to make it decidable. And luckily we can put that in the theory and say, you know, when the computer can't figure out that these two things are actually the same thing, because, you know, like the classic example is the computer can't tell that N plus K is the same as K plus N. So if you've got some dependent types with N plus K and K plus N in them, and you try to use that conversion rule, then it'll fail. It'll say, oh, like I expected a thing with the type, you know, list of length N plus K, but I got a thing of list of type K plus N. You messed up, programmer. And then we need a way to say like, no, dear computer, I did not mess up. I was merely incomplete in my explanation, dear pedantic friend. Here is some evidence that N plus K is actually equal to K plus N. And that evidence we then put in as a type, which is this equality type, which, you know, the version we use today is not actually Matelieu's original one. It's the version from Christine Pauline Mooring later on. But essentially what this lets us do is it lets us take this judgment of equality and internalize it into a thing we can say in our language rather than in our meta language. And we put everything together in a way where the computer's job is for the propositional equality, it's not to check whether two things are equal, it's to check whether I have correctly explained why they are equal. Like that's a judgment, right? Like this thing, that this term is a proof that N plus K equals K plus N.
Right.
And that's going to be some like induction thing. And this is just a whole lot trickier than anything you do before it. And right, like the kinds of dependent types you start with are things like the length index list, or you know, maybe like a proof of a number being even or odd, or you know, you maybe get some proposition, some like typical like logical connectives like conjunction, disjunction. And you know, taking this notion of equality and understanding like why you need it and how the parts fit together just requires a conceptual jump that earlier stuff doesn't. And it's fundamentally difficult. You know, I wish we'd, you know, like the reason I'm not entirely satisfied with our book is because I just talk to readers and they say like, oh yeah, I got to chapter 9 and then I gave up. And that, yeah, I'm like, dang yeah. It. Like that's the place. Like once you get past it, dear listeners, if you read The Little Typer, once you get past chapter 9, like you'll be golden. Like that's where you got to be.
You are in the wonderland and everything will open up for you and you will be freed from all your dependent issues.
At the very least, it's not that like it's going to be that hard for the rest of it.
There you go.
Yeah.
I definitely agree with you, because every time that I'm working with equality, you really have to get deeper into the notion of the eliminator for equality. You know, in order to understand what equality is doing under the hood, then you have to understand induction for equality and how it will transform things, you know, like do the conversion from one thing to another.
That's right.
And then reading that huge induction scheme, it's just can be very mind-bending, because at the same time that it's very trivial in the sense of, you know, like it's not doing much, but you know, like there's so much syntax to turn things around that just there's a little twist in your brain that is really hard to get across.
And also you look at, like, it's also hard to port intuitions from programming over to it the same way that it is. Like you look at the rules for the, like the eliminator for natural numbers and you say, okay, this looks a lot like fold R on a list if the list didn't have any elements in it or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
like, you know, computationally, it makes sense as a thing that happens. You know, the idea of like a proof by induction as a recursive function kind of makes sense, right? Because like, you've got a function that like, you know, for zero gives you a proof, and then like, it could like recur down and make proofs at each step. Like, I think it's pretty easy to get that intuitive feeling. But you look at J, like, right, for the J is the you know, the eliminator for the, yes, the traditional name for the eliminator for identity or for equality. There I go, mixing up the terminology. I'm going to say identity types, and I'm going to say propositional equality in this conversation. I'm sorry, dear listener.
What's the difference?
There isn't one. It's just like terminology.
Okay.
You know, Martin Luv calls it the identity type. Other people call it the propositional equality. You know.
You said that the equality that we use is not Martin Luv's anymore. Is
typically Pauling's. Not. Yeah. So
do you know the difference? Pauling.
Yeah. So the difference is it like if you're going to write this thing down as like a data type in like your favorite dependently typed language, does it have one parameter and one index, or does it have two indices?
I think usually one parameter and one index.
Yeah, that's right. But like Martin Luv's original one, like the original J, is the one you'd get if you wrote it down with two indices. And like, and they're equivalent, but the one with the parameter and the index is a little bit more convenient to use, mm-hmm, in a lot of contexts.
Yes. Yes.
This, like, if you're reading the hot book, this is the one called based path induction rather than passive, mm-hmm, path induction, which corresponds to like Martin Luv's original J.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Cool. I'm learning a lot here.
I think it's good to like mention people's names when they do things that don't get, that like everybody uses, but like, it doesn't always get talked about, like things, mm-hmm, that become like, you deserve credit for things that become ubiquitous.
Yeah. I definitely agree.
But right, so where were we? We were talking about equality. We were talking about the little
originally
typer.
We were talking about little typer and the ninth chapter is everyone's nightmare.
So I wouldn't say it's everyone's nightmare. It's the hardest chapter in the book, and the one that I'm a little sad that we didn't manage to get everyone through it, right? Like, mm-hmm, but yeah.
So okay. So you were teaching. You taught this class in NIU, and then you also taught at Portland State.
Yeah.
And then you, after Portland State, you called the book closed, and you didn't touch it anymore.
So the book was already done at Portland by the time that class came around.
You didn't do any new additions or changes?
No. I mean, so there's been reprintings of the book, and not for a while now, but like, I think the sales have slowed down a little bit, which is typical when a book's been out for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
6 years now, I think. Wow. So the publisher emails us when they're going to do another run, and they say like, oh, are there any errata you want to fix? And it has to be in the sense where we send them a complete PDF of a page that replaces an existing page. So we can't make any changes that change pagination. So we have fixed as many errata as we've been able to, but we have to do it on sort of creatively under certain constraints. So we can't like go in there and say like, okay, now we know a better way to explain this. Let's rip out this chapter. But you know, like if we have a typo, we can just fix the typo.
So you cannot change that ever again. Like you cannot have a next, second, third edition.
Oh, we could absolutely do that. Yeah. But then it's not a reprinting. Then it's like a new edition.
Gotcha. It's a major change. Like things will change a lot.
Then you're doing like a whole new book, and then you have like a negotiation, and you have to like do the rights and all that stuff. Gotcha. And you have to like, you know, the publisher may or may not be interested. We haven't talked to them, so I don't know if they would. I suspect they probably would be because. This is me conjecturing, MIT Press.
Okay.
This is me conjecturing rather than like working off any actual knowledge, but, the book did sell out a couple of times when it first came out. So I think they were expecting less interest than there was. And so if we positively surprised them, then probably they'd be interested in a redo, but I don't actually know for sure.
How does it work for you to get out of the idea of, okay, I want to write a book, and approaching, say, MIT Press with your book? Do you have to know someone in there? How is the process of actually publishing something?
I actually don't know, because Dan knows people in there and knows everything works. And he took care of all of the contact with the publisher and also with our great illustrator, Dwayne Bibby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, like, I think I'll have to bring him to the show now and just to make that question, because I'm very curious.
Yeah.
Like, what is the actual, you know, inner workings here?
I mean, I think the usual thing is that publishers have like an online form or an email of like an acquisitions editor who's the person who's in charge of evaluating new projects. And then sometimes the acquisitions editor will go contact prospective authors if they think like, oh, we need a book about X, then they might look up who's an expert on X and then send them some emails and say, oh, do you want to write? Like, I've gotten a couple of proposals that way from people who wanted books in the past, where I haven't done it because, like, you know, it seems like too much work, or like I don't feel like I know enough about the topic, or whatever. But so I've gotten that, I think, two times. But then also you can email them and say, hey, I want to do it. And then this is like why I'm qualified. Here's a sample chapter. And then there's like a whole thing where like you can get paid in advance, which will like cover your costs while you're doing the writing. But we didn't do any of that because the way Dan typically works is he just sends a complete book to them and then they they go through and do some proofreading and typically don't find anything because Dan's really good at proofreading already. And maybe they'll find one or two things, then you fix it, and then they send it out to reviewers. Like, so I know MIT Press has like a peer review process because they're an academic publisher, and so I know that our draft was sent out to various experts who reviewed it and who came back also with some very good feedback that made the book a lot better. I've been asked to review some books in the past, and sometimes it's like a couple chapters in an earlier stage. You're trying to say like, is this like something we should go onward with? And sometimes it's been a complete thing where like a lot of people will like put a thing on their website and then a publisher will be interested later these days. In that case, the reviewers are getting a whole manuscript. I think in other cases, they're often getting like a few chapters and then saying like go or no go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You could consider getting someone from an academic press on too, who's dealt with some of these things. The editor who worked with us, I think, has retired, unfortunately, because she was really good, but unfortunately for her, but like, yeah.
I'm not sure how much my listeners would be super interested into that, although I would. So if you're a listener and you would be interested in that, give me, send me an email. Let's see. Well, so that's the story of the little typer. Really cool stuff. We also had planned to talk about quotation and quasi-quotation. Do we have a clear path between one and another here, or we're just doing a complete change of topic now?
I mean, I thought we were going to pop over to some bidirectional type checking now, which there is a clear path on. Right?
Okay, yeah. Bidirectional type checking. Now, when you're implementing these languages inside the little typer, bidirectional type checking naturally arises then.
Becomes like a really key thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually couldn't have written the little typer without that technology.
Really?
Because we wanted... We had some key design constraints. We needed to have something that was simple to implement for our book. Like, we didn't want to have something where like getting it implemented is like really subtle and difficult. It should be something that readers could, like any reader who goes through the book could then go learn how to implement themselves. And that means that we couldn't do like higher order unification, because higher order unification is complicated and tricky, and there's a whole lot of things going on to make it work right. But if we didn't have higher order unification, then the typical approach to implementing a dependently typed language, where you have some very explicit core language where you elide the boring parts and the compiler fills them in for you, that approach isn't going to work. So like, returning to our length index list, which we dearly, dearly love, typically in the core language, something like Lean or Coq or Agda or Idris, then, we'll have like the type constructor itself, it takes a type and it takes a NAT as arguments and it gives you back a type. Okay, fine. And then you've got two other constructors. You've got the empty, like the nil empty constructor. And that one, actually behind the scenes takes a type as an argument and then returns the empty length index list of that particular type. So it looks like you think of it as like a zero argument constructor, but actually it's kind of a one argument constructor. And cons, that's not going to take an element and like a head and a tail and give you back a list. It's going to take a type and it's going to take a length and it's going to take an element which has that type. And then it's going to take the tail, which is a thing of that type and the given length, right? So con says what? Like, type, length, head, tail. That's got four arguments. And if we wanted to write our chapter on length index lists in the little typer where cons had four arguments, like it would have been unreadably huge, right? Like we've got this two column format. We need to have very, very small, pithy examples that don't take up a ton of space. So, you know, usually you'd say, okay, fine. We'll say that like these two arguments are implicit. Like the system will find them for you. And then you don't have to write them. And that works great, but then you have to have the higher order unification to go to actually do this.
Right.
And that was too hard. So we could do something much simpler, which is bidirectional type checking. And the idea of bidirectional type checking, earlier we talked about, you know, we have different forms of judgment. You've got the this thing has this type, this thing is a type, whatever. You know, in many systems, the is a type becomes like is subsumed by the has a type judgment because you've got universes. Mm-hmm. But but then in bidirectional type checking, you take this thing has this type and you split it in two. And you say one of the forms of judgment is that we can check that this thing has this type. And the other one is like, if you give me this thing, I'll give you its type.
Mm-hmm.
So they look basically like the original this thing has this type form of judgment, but now we're trying to read them algorithmically, so we're going to treat some of the positions as inputs and some of them as outputs. So, you know, if you want to read your typing rules like an algorithm, the way to read it is like, okay, we've got like a big pattern match, and the thing on the bottom of the horizontal line, like the conclusion, that's like the pattern case, and the thing above the line is then like the things we have to check to establish it.
Right.
And then you could see this as being like a monadic program because it might fail. So it's got, you know, it's an error monad. And if you're doing the whole higher unification thing, then it's also a state monad because you got to track all the constraints you're accumulating. So you've got these two forms of judgment. One of them is like you got the type coming in and the other one is the type going out. And these would then be realized as two different functions because each form of judgment in your type checker basically corresponds to like a monadic function, which is going to compute some stuff. And in super traditional dependent types, you basically run everything in the inference mode. In other words, where you give it a term and then it either fails with a nice error message or it gives you back the type, right? Or you could say like it monadically gives you back the type.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that there has to be enough information embedded in the program to reconstruct that type, which is why cons has four arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And in bidirectional type checking, you can then say that some of our bits of syntax require that the type be on its way in, because two of those arguments to cons, like the type of the elements and the length of the tail, those are actually available in the type if it's coming in. You just like, you know, it's like, oh, the type's got to be vector a n plus one, and then, you know, you sort of pattern match the type, and then you've got the length of the tail and you've got the type of the element, and then you can use those to check those. And so now you've got two monadic functions. One of them takes your, you know, let's say we're in our reader monad too, right? So we've got our typing context. I'm not going to talk about gamma here. Like everything to the left of the turnstile, just assume it's doing the right thing. Right? So we've got one where we've got our type checking where we give it a term, we give it a type, and then it should essentially be like monad of unit. Like it'll succeed if the term has that type. And then we've got our other version, which is you give it a term and then it returns like monad of type. So it'll succeed with the type if it can infer it. And doing this allows you to propagate information rather than forcing the user to write it, but it doesn't require that you're implementing higher order unification, which is where it's nice. And the other place where it can be difficult to sort of write down the dependent types system is you've got this conversion rule we talked about earlier. It's like, when do you use that? Right? Because the thing, like the property that lets you translate a set of rules into a program easily is called the rules are syntax directed, which means that when you look at the form of judgment that you want to validate with your program, there's only one rule you can take. But this conversion rule, that could work anywhere, right? Like it imposes no constraints on the expression or on either of the types that are involved. And so then in every case, you're going to say like, oh, well, like I could try the rule that fits the expression, or I could try conversion. And then like, what am I converting to? Like, where does the other type come from? Mm-hmm. And that's really painful.
Reminds me a little bit when I was talking in another episode of cut elimination, which is the reason why cut elimination makes things kind of like harder in your logic. It's because it can work kind of like anywhere. Or you know, like thinking on disjunction. Disjunction makes things a lot harder exactly because you don't know how to, you know, like the thing that you're proving in the disjunction case, right? You could be proving anything that is kind of like taking something out of the hat. Is that the same idea?
Yeah. You have an opportunity for creativity.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah. And so cut elimination, I think, is not the thing. It's the cut rule in of itself, right?
Cut rule. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Cut elimination, that just says we don't have to have it.
Right.
So the other nice thing about bidirectional type checking is it gives us a really nice hook on which to hang this conversion rule. Mm-hmm. In addition, like I talked about splitting up the typing rules. So like, you know, the ones where you've got type information coming in that you care about, you make those be the checking rule. And the ones where you don't, you make those be the synthesis rule or the inference rule. I'm going to say synthesis because inference also can mean like we've got the horizontal bar with the stuff on the top and the bottom. So then you also need two other rules, which is like, how do you change between the two?
Mm-hmm.
And one of those rules is that if I have a type annotation, like if I say that the M has type A, then that means I should check that M indeed does have that type, given the checking rule. And from this, I can then infer A, because it's right there in the program. And the other direction that I might want to change is if I've got something where I can synthesize a type and I'm trying to check it against some other type. That's where you do the conversion rule.
Mm-hmm.
The really cool thing about this technology of bidirectional type checking is that it just really scales nicely to a lot of stuff that's like kind of annoying to implement otherwise. Because what we care about here is not necessarily that the two types are equal. What we care about is that if we could infer a type A for some term and we needed to have type B, like we need to be able to check that everything that has type A can also have type B. And one way we can do that is we can say conversion, like the two are equal. Another thing we might have is subsumption. In other words, that A is a subtype of B.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually think of equality as being like the special case of subtyping where like it, you could flip it around and it would still work.
Right. A is in B, B is in A.
Yeah. If your subtyping judgment is symmetric, then you've got a type equality judgment.
There you go. That's how you learn in set theory, how equality works in set theory, if I remember correctly.
Perhaps. I'm not sure. Yeah. But this is also nice if you're trying to do like object-oriented programming and you've got a lot of subtyping going on, then this is a nice way to do it. And this is actually where bidirectional type checking got really popular, was in that community, like with the local type inference paper from Pearson Turner. And then, you know, everything derived from that, like, you know, Odersky's colored local type inference and so on and so forth, a whole ton of good stuff. And it's also useful for systems that have subtyping for other reasons, right? So another form of subtyping comes from instantiating universal quantifiers in polymorphic types. Like, let's say I need something of type int arrow int, and I've got something of type for all a arrow a. Like instantiating a as int, that's like a kind of subtyping if you look at it the right way. Or you might have systems with like, a lot of dependent type systems have what's called the cumulativity rule for the universes, which says that like if A is in universe I, then A is also in universe I plus one.
Right.
Like Koch has this. Idris 1 has this. I don't know about Idris 2. Agden, Lean do not. But what this means actually is that you need to be checking subtyping all over the place, because that is a form of subsumption rather than a form of equality that's going on. And bidirectional type checking is just a really nice place to put whatever that check is for the language you're working in. And so if we're doing dependent types, that means that you have to, you know, you check conversion there. So let's getting back to like implementing Pi from the little typer and teaching undergrads to implement Pi. You know, we write down our bidirectional typing rules. You know, we've identified for each form of judgment what's an input and what's an output. And then we can write our monadic functions or just recursive functions that might throw exceptions depending on how you want to work with things. you know, we implemented do notation as a Racket, as a Racket macro, and had them use that because that seemed to be the cleanest thing. But you know, if I was doing it for real in Racket rather than pedagogically, I just use exceptions because like the ambient monad in Racket has all sorts of cool effects. You don't need to encode them if you don't want to.
Does bidirectional type checking give you some? The way that we have been talking about bidirectional type checking so far, it makes me feel that it is something that makes things easier in the implementation perspective. So my question is, does it give you anything extra that other techniques will not be able to give you? Am I correct in what I said here? Or
almost. So to do implementation or to do like a decidability proof or whatever, like you want your thing to be like syntax directed. And mm-hmm. So bidirectional typing is one nice way to get from a non-syntax directed type assignment system to a syntax directed type system. Right. So we've got a type system with rules that are not syntax directed, like the conversion rule that we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And bidirectional type checking is not like, it's not like you put it in, turn a crank, but it's a recipe you can follow or like a methodology you can follow that will get you a syntax directed type system. And there are lots of things that you can do, but many of the easy ways to get it just involve like forcing people to put annotations all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about bidirectional type checking is that if you follow the recipe the right way, then you'll end up with a language where users don't have to write very many annotations.
I see.
Typically,
but then it can still fail eventually.
Sure.
Okay.
Fail in the sense like you can absolutely be in a situation where it's, you know, it says like we need this to be an inference mode, but the term we put there is in checking only has a checking rule, and we say like, dear user, please annotate the type here.
Exactly.
Such is life.
Right.
But if you follow the Frank Finning recipe of bidirectional type checking, then what you do is you put your introduction forms in checking mode and your elimination forms in inference mode or in synthesis mode, where you arrange that the target, like the thing that you're eliminating in your eliminator, so like, you know, the function being applied or the list that you're folding over or whatever that is, you do that in inference mode or in synthesis mode. And then the methods or the individual parts of your eliminator, like the argument to the function or the like the base case and the induction step or whatever, those you do in checking mode. And if you do this, then you typically end up with a system where users need to write type annotations around top-level definitions only, or around redexes that are embedded in the source code. But actually, we almost never put reducible expression. Like, we almost never put reducible things in a source code. Like it's very rare that you'll write a program that includes, like, lambda x of x plus 1 applied to 4, right? You'll just write 5.
Right.
And so if you follow this recipe, then you'll typically end up with something where the annotations you have to write are sort of like the ones you'd typically put in like good Haskell style anyway. Like you're putting an annotation on all your top level definitions. We took some liberties with this in the little typer to make some things type check. So there are actually some spots where you need extra annotations because it made the book nicer in certain areas. Like
gotcha.
we put some things in synthesis mode because we knew that they would work out in the book, which means that it's sometimes you have like some extra annotations when you use Pi. So if you're running into that, dear listener, I encourage you to change Pi and learn from the process because it's meant to be played with and hacked on.
Cool.
This technique has been taken all over. There's a really good survey by Jana Dunfield and Neil Krishnaswamy from a couple years ago, which is the right place to learn about it these days. It's really, really a good one. And it explores all the trade-offs of like whether you're following the Frank Finning recipe or not, because there are reasons not to sometimes and da 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 da. Like this is all really well explored in this survey paper.
Make sure to find that and put in the description.
Yeah. And there's also some problems with it, right? Like it's not a panacea. So it does require annotations that may be annoying for users, right? Like there's a lot of the time, you know, like you may find yourself putting annotations on something and thinking like, I shouldn't have to write all of this type out, right? Like I should be able to write like part of this type and the system should be able to figure it out for me. And if you're doing it the simple way, then it can't. And if you want it to, then you got to put unification in. And if you're putting unification in, then like some of the simplicity benefits go away. just because unification is difficult for non-trivial equational theories. But on the other hand, like, if I'm implementing Hindley-Milner, I always do it bidirectionally, simply not because I gain anything concrete, but like, you know, like there's sort of two ways you can do Hindley-Milner, right? One of them is the system always turns, like, you know, it infers the principal type and you get that back. Or you can have a version where you pass in a type and it's checking it against it. And then to do type inference, you pass in a fresh meta variable. And then after your type checker has run, you then see what that meta variable has been solved to be. And that's your principal type. And sort of working bidirectionally, it can be kind of nice to like have the argument be, you know, like an option of like, you know, maybe type, maybe expected type. And then that can lead to like allocating fewer meta variables and creating fewer constraints underway. And that can be like a nice little sort of minor modest performance thing sometimes.
Cool.
And like a slightly cleaner source code because you're writing a few, like somewhat fewer calls to unification, which can be make it harder to forget one by accident, which is also nice because those bugs can be annoying to track down.
For sure.
But yeah, like, you know, it's not the last word on type checking, but it's something that's got like a really nice power to weight ratio that is doesn't require a whole lot of background to understand. And it's a really good place to get started if you're trying to implement a programming language and don't exactly know where to go. Like, it's a good default to have.
Yes. Yeah. I've noticed a trend on Twitter and people talking, you know, bidirectional type checking is really hot right now. I have that feeling. Everyone's trying to learn and you're like,
okay,
oh, just use bidirectional type checking as if it's a panacea or something, right? Yeah.
It's a really good starting point. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it can cope with a lot of really hard language features and the ideas behind it aren't that complicated compared to some alternatives.
So. Yeah, for sure. And then where does quotation and quasi-quotation come in here?
I wouldn't say that it does.
No, right?
You really want to get into quasi-quotation. I think we should say what that word means then.
Okay,
so quotation. Quotation. That's the... Right. So in language, we have what we call the use mention distinction. Right? Mm-hmm. So there's a... And so we could say like, oh, like... Paris has 5 letters in it. Like... Mm-hmm. Well, if I put quotes around Paris, then that's true. If I do not put quotes around Paris, then that's absolutely not true. Like, I've been to Paris. There's a lot of signs all over the place, way more than 5 letters in that city.
Right.
Not to mention all the letters sent by mail, you know? I mean, so if you want to say, like, there's 5 letters in Paris, like, there's an important distinction between the version with the quotes and the version without the quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we call, like, the use mentioned distinction. So if we're going to use something, that means that we're evaluating it to figure out what it actually means. And that's what we're employing in our conversation. And once we're mentioning it, then we're talking about like the form in which it is expressed.
Right.
Frege had this like really classic thing on sort of a version of this, which was this paper, which has been translated a bunch of times, always with different titles. Like on sense and reference is a title you can find. Über Sinn und Bedeutung. I saw someone translated as... Oh, there's some like really weird translation in the title, which was like the best translation of the text I could find. But anyway, he has this example where when we say the morning star is the evening star. So the morning star, that's like the, you know, the last point of light as the sun comes up. Mm-hmm. And the evening star is the first one as it goes down.
Right.
And it turns out that both of them are Venus.
Right. Exactly.
But like the fact that they're both Venus doesn't mean that we don't get to be surprised when we find this out, or that we don't say that we've learned something. Right. So there we're sort of talking about the difference between like how you express something and the underlying meaning behind the scenes. And you can think of quotation as being like a very special case of this, or the use mentioned distinction. Actually, I'm kind of mixing up two different concepts here. Let's back up a little bit. So we want to talk about syntax versus semantics. So quotation is all about syntax, and not quoting things is typically about semantics.
Right.
You know, if I write down 5 + 8 in my computer, then it should say 13. It should not just come back and say 5 + 8. but in many languages, I can put some quotes around it in some way, And then it'll come back and actually say, like, oh, here's some data which represents the phrase 5 plus 8.
Right.
And that's quotation, in the same way that putting quote marks around Paris gives me a 5. There is 5, right? P-A-R-I. Yeah, okay. I just want to make sure I'm not embarrassing myself here. So, you know, like quoting it gives you back a piece of data, which you can talk about for its form rather than for its meaning or mm-hmm. for its structure. And, you know, when we're, you know, like in the Lisp world, we quotation is very convenient for various historical reasons. So people do it a lot. You know, other languages, it's either more or less convenient. It's quite convenient in Lean as well, because there's a strong Lisp heritage in Lean these days. But, you know, in I added a kind of quotation to Idris back in the day. I think Idris 2 has a different one.
What is the use case? This is a very naive question, but
that's good.
Like on a high level, what do you gain by having a good way to have quotation in your language?
That's right. So when we're writing programs, we're writing things that manipulate data. If we can make programs into data, then we can write programs that manipulate programs.
Mm-hmm.
So quotation is a way to take a program and turn it into data so that we can manipulate it with other programs, fundamentally. And we might want to do that for a lot of reasons. Like we might want to do it because we're implementing an interpreter for a different language and we want to reuse the syntax. We might want to do it because we're extending the language that we're working in and we want to, you know, have a way to talk about the new syntax we've added and how to translate it into something that the compiler already understands.
Right.
We might want to do it because we want to assign a totally different meaning to something. Like we want to, you know, implement a little embedded language for signal processors that gets compiled to some sort of high performance CUDA kernel and linked into the program. Quotation is very nice for that as well.
Yeah.
Because users don't want to write ASTs. They want to write programs.
Right. Right.
And quasi-quotation is the other term you mentioned. So quasi-quotation is something, you know, due to Quine, this logician from the 20th century, one of the most important analytic philosophers of the 20th century. And quasi-quotation is when you have a kind of quotation that can be interrupted in the middle. So like, you know, we talked about, like, we might quote 5 plus 8 to get, you know, the expression 5 plus 8. But if we're trying to work with language extensions, typically we want to work with like fragments of expressions. You know, we want to say like addition. If you see addition, translate it this way. We don't want to have to give you every single case for every single number.
Right.
And so we want to be able to say like, well, quote the middle part, like the plus part, and leave the other two things to be evaluated. So another way to approach this from is we can have is through the notion of referential transparency. So we say that like a position in a language is referentially transparent if you can replace two things that are equal according to whatever equational theory you have for like the meaning of the language, like the model or the semantics. If you can replace two things that denote equal elements, like, you know, if you could swap out an expression that denotes one thing with another expression that denotes a thing that's equal to the first thing,
mm-hmm.
then that position is called referentially transparent.
Okay.
And a position is referentially opaque if you can't do that. So, and this is relevant to quotation because quoted positions are referentially opaque, right?
Mm,
so,
right.
So like, you know, Paris is the capital of France, but the capital of France is not a 5-letter word.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you can think of quasi-quotation as being a way to insert referentially transparent sub-expressions into the referentially opaque quotation.
Ah, I see. Okay. Right. So maybe something along the lines of, well, if you see the plus sign into this quoted term, I want it to change to a star because this is how I want to talk about the plus.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
Or maybe to pick a more realistic example, let's say we're working in a programming language that doesn't have let. And we know that we can implement let by translating it into like a beta redex, right? So like let x equal 5 in E. You know, that's essentially like saying, you know, like lambda x E applied to 5.
Right.
And you can't quite do this in type theory for various reasons, but you can do it in most languages. And then when you when you're building this up, like, let's say I'm like writing the right-hand side of this function, the thing that'll return the new syntax of the results of the translation, then I might want to say, you know, I'm going to write quote lambda, and then I'm going to say unquote x, because the name is whatever name the user wrote. It's not the x here in my program. It's the x from the user. Right. So I'd say, like, you know, so quote lambda, unquote x, requote, and then dot or arrow or whatever it is I use to get from the name to the body of the function.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to say, you know, unquote e, like the other expression the user wrote. If it's like requote again, and then like that whole thing applied to, and then unquote 5, because that's where we're, our let binding thing. I think that's a decent example.
Right. That explains why I'm always confused when I see quotation, because there's so much quoting and unquoting depending on what you're trying to do. Because as you said here, the X is the actual name that we're talking about. It's not now the five-letter word, right? We want the actual thing in there.
Yeah. Mm. Mm-hmm. And this is in code transformation is where this comes up a lot. And then most systems that have good quasi-quotation, you can also put it in like a pattern position where it works like pattern matching usually does, where the things you unquote become like normal patterns of your language that could to just like match a thing and like bind variables.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to implement this in Racket as a macro, this particular transformation, which is one of the things you do in like macro writing first lesson, this is one of the things you implement.
Right.
Then I'd have a pattern which looks like something along the lines of quote let unquote x quote requote equals unquote thing.
Dang.
Requote in unquote body. And then like, you know, x, thing, and body are then normal pattern variables, because variables in a pattern context, they just bind whatever's there. And then those values are then on the right-hand side, and then I can fill them in. So I could have quasi-quotation on the left and the right of my pattern match, and I get something that looks basically like the rule you'd write down in paper. So you're implicitly quasi-quoting stuff whenever you write down like typing rules, because you'll sort of like use like italic stuff in like mathematical italic stuff in LaTeX to mean like meta variable.
Right.
You could think of quasi-quotation as being like a way of talking about meta variables in that sense.
More formally, to be specific and explicit where things are from one language and when things are from another language.
Or whether they're from quoted or not quoted things in the same language, which is where you typically find it. Like, because quotation isn't something that takes you up to a meta language. Quotation is the thing that keeps you in the language that you're in.
Same language.
Yeah. And like Quine invented this to like write down the rules of logic. And, you know, he's using Greek letters for the unquoted stuff and non-Greek letters for everything else. But like in Lisp, it's typically like a backtick and a comma, or in Clojure, like a backtick for quasi-quote and a tilde for unquote. In Lean, it's a backtick for quasi-quote and a dollar sign for unquote. Yeah, there's a lot of different syntaxes out there.
This sounds like a pretty hard problem looking in this perspective. What are the difficulties implementing this stuff?
I mean, actually, it's not that hard typically, right?
Really?
If you've got a parser, then you can say, you know, like parse anti-quotation this way, and then, you know, whatever the parser would emit for the AST, it needs to know how to quote it. There's two ways to do this. Either it can construct an AST of an AST, which is the bad way to do it, because then you get a quadratic size explosion, or you just have your AST behind the scenes say, like, I'm now entering a quotation, I'm now entering an anti-quotation.
Right. There seems to be a lot of discussion in the programming languages community on how, I mean, this is coming from a perspective that I don't know much about quotation or macro expansion, but it seems to me that there's a long debate on how to implement macros properly and a whole thing about hygiene macros. Yes. Could you tell us a little more about those things?
Yeah. I want to correct something I just said, though. Quotation does get really hard when you want to start talking about like the logical implications of it. Then you start getting into like modal type theory and contextual modal type theory and all sorts of really cool stuff. But like, let's not get into the modal logic side, just in case anybody's listening out there is like, oh, like he said, it's easy. Only like the thing you have in old school Lisp is easy. Like otherwise it gets complicated.
When you're trying to reason about the quotation, it gets hard. That's the idea.
Yeah. Like,
okay.
So I mean, you know, this like necessity modality is sort of a kind of
how does that pop up?
So we're getting a little bit outside of the things okay, I know well. Fine. Let's go back to our other plan. I just wanted to like leave a little for cookie for people who want to follow up on some cool stuff. And we're going to talk about macros, which I know a lot more about than I know about contextual modal type theory.
Awesome.
So, right, macros. Macros are like it's a term used for a few things. I'm going to talk about a specific tradition of macros. So like a C macro is a string to string transformation. We're not talking about that. We're talking about syntax to syntax transformations. So you've already got a tree structure and you want to produce a new tree structure rather than like you've got some strings and you want to swap them out. So
okay.
And if we're going to do that, then this is a feature that we typically have in like the Lisp tradition of languages, and it's spread from there a little bit in the many decades since it was invented. And the idea is that you can have a small language with a small number of primitives, and then users who want more features can implement them by locally translating them to the already existing features or the already implemented features. And when I say locally, that's an important property of these. Like macros don't let you walk the entire source of your language and like, do some complicated analysis or, like put the entire program in continuation passing style, then do some other stuff. They don't let you do that. But you could like say, this little bit, put that into continuation passing style and then use that to implement something or whatever it is you're doing. And the idea is like it started off with things like implementing let by translation to a beta redex. And then as people do, they start writing more and more complicated macros. And then we end up with a problem, which is that the system of quotation that we've described here doesn't respect lexical scoping. Like if I quote X and then I move it to some other context where there's a different X as a bound variable, then all of a sudden the meaning of that quotation is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because presumably you're quoting things because eventually you're going to want to generate some code that's going to be interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of simple notion of quotation we were talking about doesn't take scope into account at all, which is where a lot of that contextual type theory stuff comes in if you want to do it in the logic. But the other thing you can do is you can say, all right, where does this, like, what's the problem with it not respecting scope? And there's basically two problems that come up. Both of them are forms of variable capture. One of them is where a name in the quoted code or in the code being generated refers to something other than the implementer of the code generator intended it to refer to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like maybe I've got a top level definition of X and then somebody uses the macro in a context that like let binds X to something else. And then it generates the wrong reference. The other thing that could happen is that the macro itself could introduce a binding which captures something that occurs in some code the user wrote. So, this isn't a problem with let, but let's say we had something like let that also introduced some other local binder. Then if there's something in the body of that let which contains Y and that happened to be just bound as a helper, then we end up with a problem. And you often need to introduce bindings in Lisp macros because it's a strictly evaluated language. So if you have an expression that you want to occur multiple times, then you'll end up evaluating it twice. And if you have side effects, that's really bad. So what you'll typically do is you'll control that evaluation by having the macro generate code that evaluates it once, let binds the result, and then puts that name wherever you want it. But then you've got a situation where you're coming up with a name and like hoping that users don't use it by accident. This is untenable. So yeah. The traditional Lisp solution, which is still done in Clojure for some reason, is to use something called gensim, which just concocts a fresh name. It just makes a new name that could never be used anywhere else. And then you stick that in the binding position, you stick that in the use positions, and then in multiple invocations of the macro, we'll get new fresh names, like user code can't use it. And that's great if you remember to do it consistently. But experience shows that expecting programmers to take care of subtle details that occasionally bite them seriously wrong, but are really hard to test is not a recipe for success.
Yeah.
And like you know, that said, like, people write big complicated systems that are highly reliable in C all the time. It's not impossible. It's just hard, right? Yeah. You know, people write big complicated macros in Common Lisp and Clojure all the time, and they're fine because they know what to do and they're very disciplined and it works out. But on the other hand, like, I find that if I'm kind of working at the edge of my own capacities, then having to keep track of those details is difficult. And it means that, like, I'm less able to do expressive and interesting stuff. So the idea of macro hygiene is to say that the computer does it for you. So names coming in from user code can never be captured by names introduced by code generated by the like bits of code or wrappers of code generated by the macro. And, you know, names in the macro will never, will always refer to the thing that they're supposed to refer to. So in some sense, it's not like putting the scoping in the logic, but it's instead arranging this system that repeatedly looks for things that need expanding and expands them, such that it takes care of the details for you and has like a good default that respects lexical scoping automatically. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yes, yeah. I'm following.
Cool. And there's a bunch of technology for this. I think the state of the art is still Matthew Flatt's bindings as sets of scopes paper from Popple 16, I think. That's a really nice paper because a lot of prior descriptions of hygiene are much more difficult to understand than this one. Like, this one has a really nice explanation. He gave a really good talk at Strange Loop a few years ago, which I highly recommend to anybody who wants to write a macro expander, because, like, I tried writing macro expanders a few times, and I watched that talk, and I sat down and just did it, and it was great. And that macro expander actually turned into, like, a really fun project, which is this thing. I've been trying to, like, look at, like, how do we do macros for type languages? Because I like types, and I like macros, and generally, there's not a good story for that, historically speaking. You know, most of the really nice macro systems have been in dynamically typed languages, and, you know, often statically typed ones have kind of fallen behind. Like, you know, not always. Like, you know, Scala has some decent stuff, but historically, that's been a real challenge. And in particular, it's like, well, like, you know, I love Haskell too. How do we get this in Haskell? And then I was, what was it at? I think it must have been Compose Conference in New York. And I met, you know, Samuel Gillino, and he had this idea, like, he was wanting macros in Haskell too, where, and, like, we've got template Haskell, but he wanted a version of template Haskell where the thing doing the expansion could say, like, what type is this expression supposed to have? Because then I could generate different code. Like, maybe, you know, I'm writing my DSL and I could say, like, oh, well, if this is being done, you know, if this expression is being used in a context where it's going to be, you know, a 32-bit word, then I can, you know, generate super fast code. Whereas if it's going to be in an area, in something that's like any num instance, then I can't. And, you know, that would be nice. But the problem is that when you're in these kinds of, you know, ML derived languages or things in like the broad ML family, then the type may not be known when the compiler wants to generate the code, right? It might say, like, oh, well, like, this type is going to be determined by this thing over here, but I haven't gotten to type checking it yet, so it's still like this unsolved meta variable. So what do we do? And he had this great proposal, which is like, okay, we're gonna get stuck, and like, let's, you know, and then like not do any more work for a while, and then, you know, we'll come back to it later, and then, like, if the meta variable is solved, then we're done, right? Because you don't want to take an arbitrary choice because you might generate something for the wrong type or you might miss an optimization possibility. And even worse, the order that the type checker visits the program and like generates the constraints that are solved to like fill out these unification variables, that can change at any time. Like the glorious thing about the principal typing result for Hindley-Milner is that like you could just like have the type checker run backwards, or you could have it, you know, like use the phases of the moon to figure out in which order to traverse the program. And it's fine. Like, you know, maybe the error message will be different, or like in a different spot, but like any well-typed program will still be well-typed and it'll still have the same type no matter what order you traverse it in. But once you start having macros that can observe the inner workings of this process, then that goes out the window. And so you'd end up with really, really fragile metaprograms because, you know, if you change the order of traversal, then like all of a sudden this thing is no law is like it was known, now it's not anymore. And so we want to make the macro inspection independent of that in some sense. But and so I've been working on like writing macro expanders and like, you know, like interleaving a macro expander with a bidirectional type checker because I wanted to solve this problem. But you know, then we just said like, oh, like you're in a checking position, that means you've got a type coming in, cool. You know, like it meant that like you could only have macros go check their types in a position where you're in checking mode. But like doing it in Haskell, like that would be even cooler than doing it in my little toy implementation. And so we kind of put our heads together. It's like, all right, we're going to write ourselves an implementation of your thing. Cause like you've got this cool idea. You know, I've learned how to write a macro expander. So let's sit down and do it. And so we like sat down and like hacked and got like an initial implementation together that day. And then, you know, I was working at Galois at the time and there we had a week, a year to kind of work on whatever interesting thing we wanted. And so, you know, the whole time I worked there, this project was my thing. And then, you know, before I had a kid, I had some time in the evenings to sit and hack. And like, it's kind of on like a slow burn right now. Like there's, you know, we're three people working on it these days. Jeffrey Young is also part of it, but it's, you know, all of us are pretty busy. And so it's a pretty slow burn. If anybody's listening to this who wants to get involved, let us know. Like, I think that there's like, I got a whole series of cool papers you can write if you're a PhD student and who thinks this sounds cool. Right, so what we have in this system, we called it klister, which is Danish for like sticky. Because like, you know, it's getting stuck. So it's like yeah. a really bad pun in that like mixes Danish and English because like we really couldn't find another name for it.
Naming is hard.
Yeah, it is. But what happens there is that if a macro tries to observe the type it's being expanded at, and that type is an unsolved meta, then we just capture the continuation and like save it for later. And then when the meta gets solved, then we put it back on. So this actually looks a lot like the way you do an elaborator for a real dependently typed language, because, you know, higher order unification, maybe you don't have enough information to get into the pattern fragment yet. So you get to like postpone this constraint and then revisit it later. And so eventually you're going to, you know, you've traversed the whole program, you've got a collection of constraints, you've got some unsolved metas, and you're going to iterate over your collection of constraints and say, like, can we solve any of them now? If so, yes, cool, we fill out part of the program. And then, you know, if we get all the way through and we can't, then we say, okay, the user needs to write some type annotations. And you get, you know, I think yellow is the color you get in AGDA for that. Maybe it's orange. I think it's yellow. So we ended up with a system that was very much like this, right? You know, we've got a collection of not unification constraints, but rather macro expansion tasks to be carried out. And each of those are sort of blocked on certain meta variables being solved. And then, you know, we just essentially iterate through our queue. And if we get all the way through the queue without anything being able to run, then we terminate and say, dear user, please add a type annotation. But, you know, in principle, like this isn't something we've proved, like the meta theory still has to be done. But in principle, we should be able to, you know, run the, like, randomize the order of the traversal every time and still have that nice property that like well-typed programs, like all well-typed programs are still well-typed, all ill-typed programs are still ill-typed, and the well-typed ones elaborate to the same core language term with the same type. I think that's true. I just don't know how to prove it yet. essentially, this becomes like an exercise in deterministic parallel programming. And so we actually think that we can build like a better version on top of LVARs, like Lindsay Cooper's stuff. And we talked to her a little bit about this and we're optimistic, but one of the cool papers you could write based on this stuff would be an incremental macro expander, which nothing has yet, you know, where you could, you know, damage the program and then only like re-macro expand the parts that changed, as opposed to having to start from scratch every single time the user presses a key, which could make a much more responsive editor for a system with really fancy macros, which would be cool. Because essentially that's the special case of klister where there's only one type, or where the macros can't ask what the type is. You've still got this nice task queue structure, and you've still got this way of reordering tasks and all that kind of stuff.
You mentioned LVAR. What is an LVAR?
L is short for lattice. So the idea in deterministic parallel programming is that you want to get work done in parallel. You want to have communication between threads. And nonetheless, you want it to be the case that you get the same answer every time.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you've got a bunch of threads running and they're, you've got shared mutable state, then typically you won't have that property. The question is, like, how do we make languages or APIs where we get determinism because we care that the answer is the same answer every time, but where we can get some parallel speedups, maybe less than if we weren't deterministic, but still better than doing the whole thing linearly. And the idea in LVARs is that you structure the communication between them so that every shared variable has an underlying lattice of values. And then when you read from the variable, you don't just say, like, I'm going to read the answer. You say, like, here's this threshold through the lattice such that, and then let me know when the value that the person that has been written to it crosses this threshold, and then I'll unblock and keep going.
Interesting.
And those are more flexible than, like, write once variables. Variables you can write to exactly once, like IVARs in Haskell. Those are a very special case of this, right? Like, it's just the two-element lattice where you've got nothing and something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can block until something gets there. But maybe you want to be able to write more than one time to something. And this gives you a nice discipline for doing it. I thought the paper was super cool.
That sounds pretty cool. Like good stuff. But it does sound like dealing with macros and quotation is pretty hard. There's a lot going on under the hood.
I mean, yes and no. Huh. Like, for most people who want to use macros in something like Racket or Lean, it's just a matter of saying, like, I'm going to write down something that looks like the rules on paper, right? Like, I'm going to write, I've got some meta variable, like, I've got this bit of syntax, and it turns into this bit of syntax, and I'm done. Like, and having hygiene just means, like, I don't have to worry about this thing. It doesn't, like, implementing it, that gets pretty hairy.
Yeah,
that's like a special interest of mine. So I'm into it, but like, if the conclusion is that, like, there's a lot of subtleties when you're implementing metaprogramming systems and macro expanders, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Especially if you have typeset mm-hmm. hand. But that doesn't mean that they're like super tough to use necessarily.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking on the implementation perspective for sure. Do you think lean macros are good?
Yes. I do.
They is there anything special about them or
So when you say lean macros, I'm going to interpret that as meaning like lean metaprograms.
Right.
Because like macros are like one of the kinds of metaprograms you can write in lean.
What else do you have?
We call them elaborators. So mm-hmm. So a macro translates syntax to syntax. Whereas so in lean, there's like a high level syntax that users write that the parser generates. And then there's a core language, which is like defined ahead of time and not extensible. And the job of the elaborator is to translate the syntax the user writes into that core language. And so macros translate one bit of syntax to another bit of syntax. But also you can add new elaborators for syntax you write where the thing you write translates it to the core language all the way. So macro goes like surface syntax to surface syntax. Elaborator goes surface syntax to core language.
Gotcha. Okay.
And the reason why that's important is that there's a lot of things you want to do when you're extending a system like lean or like a dependently typed system. Like, you might want to say, dear higher order unification, are these two things equal?
Right.
And that doesn't make sense in terms of high level syntax. That only makes sense in terms of the core language. So if you want to be doing those things, then you have to be working at that lower level of abstraction.
Gotcha.
And there it's important that you can sit down and write it.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes you don't want to do those things and then you don't want to pay the price. And then you can write a quick and simple macro that says, like, take this thing and turn it into this other thing.
I think I remember one presentation that Leo was doing in the early days. I think like it was still Lean 3. It was like Lean 3 was still coming out. Yeah. I think he was an ITP, gave it a talk, and he was mentioning something along those lines of it is very important for metaprogramming to be done right, to have that kind of elaboration and macro expansion done properly. And I think it's related to how in Coq, for example, you actually need to use LTEX, but then in Lean, you get direct access to the core language through
These are two different concerns.
Different things?
So Lean 3 didn't have the macro system that Lean 4 mm-hmm. has. What Lean 3 had was a system for writing tactics in Lean, mm-hmm. where rather than having like a dedicated tactic language like LTAC or a sort of low level separate language for writing tactics like OCaml can serve that role in Coq, you instead have use the language itself as its own tactic language. And that's that's related but different. So
right. What brought me this idea is exactly because now you're accessing and you're manipulating the core terms inside your own syntax. Sure. This seems like an idea of quotation, right?
Well, you use quotation is a necessary or an incredibly useful tool to have in your toolbox when you're doing these things.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because if you want to write down a term, like you don't want to write down its AST as a bunch of constructors. You want to write it down in the syntax you use to write things down usually. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so it's like there's definitely like quotations and such in Lean 3. But it didn't have the use of Lean for like adding arbitrary new language features to Lean as it's going, like Lean 4 has, which is where it's really powerful and really fun.
I don't know how used to Coq notation you are, but I'm thinking here, how do they compare?
I don't know how that one works behind the scenes. Yeah. I'd have to go look. Like my point of departure here has really been Racket. I've written notations in Coq, but
it seems to me that Coq, what it's doing is you are kind of changing the language itself, like the parser of the language in compile time, which blows my mind, honestly.
Yeah, you do that in Lean 2.
Right.
So a lot of languages have made it possible to change the concrete syntax as you're processing it. Like, you know, traditional Lisps had this thing they called reader macros, where you could say like, you know, reader is like Lisp-ese for parser. Right. I mean, so it's like Lisp has sort of a slightly different approach to these things where you've got a concrete syntax, which is like a fairly thin layer on top of a data type. And then everyone works with that data type. And the reader is the thing that goes from characters to that. And then you've got the macro expander that goes from that to what the compiler understands and the compiler. And that's very much like an elaborator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except in Lisp, they're usually like the same data type, but just the compiler only understands these things. Anyway, you could go in and you could add like if you're adding hash tables to the language, you could add a concrete syntax for hash table literals with a reader macro, and that works fine.
Wow.
So what that means is you need a way to extend the code running in the parser with like code the user wrote.
Yeah.
And I don't know what algorithm is used in Coq for this. Lean has like the Lean parser is sort of basically a Combinator parser behind the scenes with an added mm-hmm. layer of like Pratt parsing for dealing with infix operators and precedences and things like that, which makes it significantly more convenient to use in practice than if it didn't have that. Idris 1 certainly like that there. You could also add new parsing rules if you wanted. This is a thing that a number of languages, I think Perl 6 has it too, but it would surprise me if it didn't because Perl 6 has everything. I say being a fan of languages with everything, you know, like, so definitely you're extending the concrete syntax and then I think you're just basically defining a macro, right? Like you're mm-hmm. defining a translation from the syntax that you've added to some other thing, to some notation that some other syntax that the system already understands.
Right.
My understanding is that they don't have hygiene in that system. I don't know if they do. Like LTAC certainly doesn't have hygiene. Like you know, right. LTAC will like randomly capture names for you and, yep. and things like that. But yeah, so, but the way it works in Lean is, you know, notation is essentially a macro that expands to the definition of a macro is a way to think about it, right? Like it's a, like there's, you know, you can write down something that looks like the cock notation command, and then behind the scenes, it's producing a macro.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple other things that are that like it, it's restricted what you can write there, so it can produce some other stuff for you that you have to build by hand if you want it for an arbitrary macro. Yeah, I don't know how binders are handled, for example, in
yeah. presentation. Yeah, I'm not sure, but so we're talking about elaborators in Lean and how it allows you to really start talking about the core syntax.
That's right. So when you write something in Lean, there's a parser, an extensible parser. That mm-hmm. extensible parser produces something of type syntax. The type syntax, I think, has like four constructors, where one of them is atom, which is like any literal, you know, mm-hmm. number or string or whatever. One of them is identifier, like X or five. You know, atoms could also be keywords like if or then or else.
Ah.
And then there's missing, which means there was a parse error and that we recovered from. and then there's node. And the node has a kind, which is just like essentially, it's a name, but it's essentially a string. Like it says like, oh, I'm an if then else, or I'm a function application or whatever.
Huh.
And then it's got some, and then it's got a collection of subnodes, like an array of subnodes, which are themselves syntax.
Hmm.
That's it. So that's what the parser is spitting out. And when you extend the parser, you're also sort of coming up with a new name to go in that like identifier for the new node.
Right.
Is the way it's working behind the scenes.
Gotcha. Oh, I see. So that's where the extension happens, isn't the node.
Yeah, yeah. And then, and also the atoms, right? Like, because the parser could produce some random atom. But if you declare like an extension to some syntactic category, like here's a new kind of term, then what you're getting is like, you know, it'll name that thing that you're adding, and then you'll get a node with that name in the name slot.
Right.
Which we call kind, you know, like the kind mm-hmm. of the node is the name.
Can you also add some sort of precedence?
That goes in the parser side. Like the syntax data type doesn't talk about precedence because the parser takes care of that. But yeah, like when you define parser extensions, the Pratt parsing layer means you can put precedence and associativity and all that stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so macros you can think of as like a monadic function from syntax to syntax. The reason it's monadic is, first off, a macro can fail. So it can say like, oh, I don't know how to deal with this after all. You know, like, gotcha. like the syntax admits it, but we don't like it. or it can also fail in a way which says like, let somebody else handle it. And that means that you can have you can extend macros with new pattern match cases that like recover from failures and say like, oh, well, like nobody else knew how to do it. Let me give it a try.
Cool. Cool. So kind of like the effect handler sort of way. Into the monad.
Not really. No, this is way simpler than handlers. Okay. Way simpler than handlers. Think of it as like every syntax kind that is a macro is associated with like a list of functions that could deal with it. And then it just like walks down that list until one of them doesn't fail. That's cool. All.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just, you know, we got a list of stuff and we're just trying them one by one.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the other thing you have is the elaborator. The elaborator you can think of as being a monadic function from syntax to core language. The other thing macros are monadic for is because that's where hygiene comes from. So every time a macro is expanded, it's done in a context with a new like scope indicator thing. And that scope indicator gets stuck onto the quotations of syntax that you have such that bound variables are kept distinct.
Cool.
They come from a quotation.
Gotcha.
This is different from the way Racket does it. Like Racket puts the scopes in a different way. But so, yeah. But in Lean, it's done at quotation time. Mostly because like that's simpler and Lean has fewer features than Racket does, so it can get away with doing the simpler thing.
Huh.
Like there's no locally defined macros and that kind of thing. But So the elaborator is this monadic function, and that monad has a lot more power. Like the, you know, the macro expansion monad, you know, it can do hygiene and it can fail. Basically, that's it. Whereas the elaboration monad, that can do unification, it can do, you know, type class synthesis, it can, you know, like, give me the instance of this thing, it can do evaluation, it can anything you can do with your language, you can do there. And you can bind variables, all this stuff. Add definitions to the global context. Like, if you want to, like, oftentimes you might want to, like, lift something out to, like, a global definition because, right. Yeah. And then you can do that in the elaboration monad and so forth.
I've saw that you wrote a blog post a couple of months ago on how to use these techniques to help you write a parser, if I'm not mistaken.
No, it's not a parser.
What is that?
So it's a kind of quasi quotation. Mm-hmm. So the idea, not the built-in lean form of quasi quotation, but like one that we might want for some other purpose. So the idea is that if you're working with an interactive theorem prover, and you're wanting to like prove something about some programming language, then you want to use a convenient syntax to write it down rather than an inconvenient syntax. And we want to do this for a lot of reasons. Like, one is just to have the program be readable. But also, a typical thing we'll do is we'll prove a lot of stuff about some minimal language. And then we will say, like, oh, well, we can encode the things we care about in this minimal language. So we don't have to prove things about a big language. We can get away with proving about a small language. But then if you want to test it, and you often want to test things before you try to prove them, because then you'll find some like modification you need to do, right, or something.
Which is much less cost of, yeah, costs, yeah, a lot less to test. Yes.
That's right. And it's also just like fun to play with your language. Like, it's very motivating. And working with the like encoding of a language as an AST is just super annoying. You want to write it down with a convenient syntax. Mm. But if you want to write these encoding functions, like, let's say you've implemented, this is an example in the blog post, like, let's say you've implemented, you know, untyped lambda calculus, and you want to, you know, have numbers, then you church numerals, and writing church numerals by like church numeral addition is like annoying, but church numeral addition encoded as the AST of the term is completely unreadable. And so what you want to do is you want to have a way to write or like even just like converting a number to church numerals. Like, you want to write down 5 and have it spit out, you know, lambda
F, n, lambda, yeah.
Lambda F, lambda X, F, 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 X, right?
Right.
Like, that just gets annoying. So what we want to do is we want to do like, oh, quote lambda, whatever. And then we want to be able to unquote and escape because, you know, we need to write some like code to do some manipulation for the middle bit. And then we've got this problem of bound variables again. And how do we deal with the bound variables? Because if we bind a variable on outside of our anti-quotation, and then we escape to lean because we want to write some programs to do some term manipulation, but then we want to go back to quoting mode to like make some little bits that go in there, we want to be able to refer to the bound variables coming from the outer quotation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the blog post is basically an exploration of some ways of doing that. Oh, and I've got a follow-up one where the code examples are written, but I haven't actually written the text yet that does even more fun stuff. But the idea is that, like, you've got variable capture becoming a problem once again.
Right.
Right. So, like, what if in my lean code, I want to refer to a name that's surrounding it that would be captured by the quotation? That'd be a problem. So this means that I don't want to use lean's own binding forms behind the scenes to implement the binding forms of my embedded language.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I do, then I have variable capture problems.
Right.
And also the other way around, you know, if I let bind some stuff in my metacode and then I go back to my object language, that shouldn't be captured either.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got this problem, like, well, macros are also only local transformations. Like, how do we communicate from the outer quotation to the inner quotation and say, I have these variables available for you? Because we also want to give out of scope errors if I have a typo. And the solution in this post kind of abuses lean's own hygiene mechanism. So remember, I was talking earlier that, like, macros, one of the reasons they're in a monad is that they can get this like unique scope indicator and stick it on things. It turns out that with suitably evil code, you can get one of these things and extract it and just like save it for later and just have it like save it in a global variable. So you can write some metacode, which like gets you a definitely unique scope indicator. And then you can use that for your own purposes. So you know, we said like, oh, we don't want to reuse lean's binding because it'll capture things. But if we reuse lean's binding, but stick one of these scope indicators on the bound variable in the quotation areas, and we do it again in the use sites, then they will neither capture nor be captured. In other words, we can steal the hygiene mechanism that lean has for its own macro hygiene and use it to implement our own notion of hygiene for our own little embedded language. Wow. and get a really nice syntax for writing things down.
That is really cool.
It was so much fun. I had a lot of fun like trying to figure out how to do this. But what it doesn't give you is like ways to communicate much other stuff. So like in Racket, there's this notion of like compile time information associated with the binding. So you can like bind a thing, and that like gives you like a runtime binding. Like you say X is let bound or X is lambda bound here. And then if you're generating code with an X, it'll grab that. But the code doing the generating may also want to know stuff about X. So in Racket, there's this nice convenient thing you can do where you can say like, well, like I've got that binding. I'm also at like the compile time version of the binding. I'm going to say like, oh, it's got this type, or oh, it's linear, and I've got this reference cell where I'm saying how many uses it has. I've never tried that. Maybe that won't work, but definitely you could like save a type in there, or you could save, you know, like maybe you've got a language with like separate namespaces. You could save which namespace it's in. Maybe you're doing system F and you want to keep like type variables and term variables distinct, whatever. Like that's the kind of thing you can put in the compile time information. And so the follow-up post is like, how do we do this in lean where we don't have that feature? Like, and the solution will hopefully be in a follow-up blog post in the next month or two.
Awesome. Yeah. We will be expecting for that. And yeah, everyone, I'm sure everyone will go straight ahead and take a look at that blog post, the first one, and we'll be waiting for the second one. Well, with all of this being said, I think we've covered a lot. I think this is one of my most technical episodes we've ever done.
Uh-oh.
And it was awesome. I learned a lot today. Yes, exactly. I usually try to keep things a little less technical, but okay. some people start asking for things to get more technical. So I'm trying to find a balance here and see how things goes and see how people will respond. So if anyone have any questions about any of these things, make sure to send on our Discord. We have a Discord over there. I might ping David to chime in if anyone has any questions. Do we have on the blog? Do you have a comment session?
We do not. That's intentional.
Smart.
I mean, so if people have questions about lean related things, I'd send them to the Lean Zulip. Is really the place to go.
It's extremely active. Yeah.
Yeah. I think if you put comments on a blog post, like that means that like maybe I might see it and then like forget about it because I'm busy. Whereas if you go ask on the Lean Zulip, then there's a lot more people who could answer, and you can ping me there, and I'd be happy to do my best to answer things. But my experience with the Lean Zulip is that like people ping me with a question and then like, you know, I see it and then like, you know, a half an hour later, I'm like, all right, let me go answer. And like three other people have already answered it.
Lean Zulip, it's so active. There are so many people answering things all the time there. People are so smart and kind as well. I wish I had more time to, you know, like be more active in those communities, but there are so many cool communities to be part of that it's hard to choose which ones.
Yeah, I really have to keep it at a minimum just because that's, I mean, like, you know, you and I were emailing about this and I just like didn't answer your emails a lot. And that's just, you know, I'd like
being
to do
an adult,
better. But
being
like,
an adult is hard, man. It's been like, an adult.
And like, if I'm on a bunch of chats, then like no emails will ever be answered. So like right now I'm treading water. But
Is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you think would be useful to talk about?
Not that we could fit in the time that we have.
Just out of curiosity.
I think that the missing piece from the story about how do you implement Pi, that was normalization by evaluation.
And how does it fit together with bidirectional type checking?
because when you're implementing your subsumption rule and you want to check are these two types the same type, then that sameness is not going to be alpha equivalence, right? You know, it's going to be with respect to like all the computation rules built in, where you say like, oh, I'm going to like 3 + 5 = 8.
And that's where normalization by evaluation comes in.
So what you need to do is you need to have a way of deciding like, are these two things equal or not? And normalization by evaluation is a really elegant, nice, understandable way to do this that is not the be all and end all. Like, there are other techniques that also work well, but this one is, I think, the one, another one of those ones that's like a good place to start, and that there was like a high power to weight ratio. Because the idea is that you've already got an interpreter for your language. Like, you've already got that. And you can turn the interpreter into a thing that computes a normal form with sort of one cool trick. And so maybe we can do a follow-up sometime on,
on
why
sure.
this is one of my favorite ideas.
I'm very glad that you brought that up, because I think bidirectional type checking together with normalization by evaluation are the two most hot things I see around on Twitter, on Reddit, even sometimes people talking about these things as is, you know, like the golden bullet that will solve all your problems forever.
It's not.
In
it's
languages.
Not. So I wrote this tutorial for these classes that we taught. I've got a Racket version and a Haskell version. They're both on my webpage. So if you want to go learn about that, that might be a place to go. DavidChristiansen.dk.
I have a confession that even nowadays, I remember that I was we were talking and you gave me that paper for me to give it a read. And I still beat myself up that I couldn't keep up and give you some feedback on that. So I apologize.
I apologize for being hard to get a hold of by email.
Awesome.
We're good. Life is big. There's too many interesting things to do.
It is true. Especially in the middle of a very cool internship in an amazing place, right? Well, so with that, you will definitely be coming back in the future. I don't know how near, the definite future.
Wonderful.
And
happy to. I think
that's it. Thank you so much for your presence. Thanks so much for this part too. And
thanks for having me.
Awesome. Take care. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode as much as I did. I personally consider David to be a mentor in my life. I remember when I was just an undergrad in Brazil listening to Type Theory podcast. Back then, I would never dream that one day I would be the one running an interview with him like this. I'm pretty happy. This was really cool. In any case, I'm happy to announce that I finished my master's and I'm going back to Brazil now, and I'm officially unemployed. So more than ever, I would appreciate if you guys could support us donating through Ko-Fi. Just go to our website, typetheoryforall.com, follow the prompts, and with $5 monthly, you can become a VIP member in our Discord server, participate in very cool discussions, and send in our guests questions. I always let my patrons to know who the next guest is going to be, when that's going to happen. I'm still trying to figure out if I'm able to receive people to watch the lives. But that's something I'm still working on. But I think I can make that happen for next episodes if you guys would be interested. In any case, if you have any questions about this episode, as we mentioned, you can send it on Lin Zulip, or you can send in our email, typetheoryforall@gmail.com. I am also currently looking for a partnership with the industry. So if you work in a technology company and you think would make some good synchronicity as partners, please reach out at typetheoryforall@gmail.com. And I think that's it for today. Make sure to tell your moms you love them. I'll see you guys next time.